Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, May 1st, 2014. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Dr. Chris White, founder of White Labs Yeast, joins Chris Colby and me to talk about a survey his company is doing on how different yeast strains affect the measured bitterness levels of beer. Also, we talk about some safety issues and whether eating yeast can stave off drunkenness. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. You can follow me on Twitter. My username is basicbrewing, all one word. Also, you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james, and our show page on Facebook is at facebook.com/basicbrewing. We're on Google Plus, too. Thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. You know how that works. Whenever you feel the itch to shop on Amazon, go to basicbrewing.com first. Click on our link, our Amazon link, and it will take you to Amazon. It won't cost you any extra, but you'll be helping us to bring you the show, and we greatly appreciate your support. We also have associate links for Brewer Your Own magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site as well. You can find our Basic Brewing iPhone app on iTunes and our Android app on Amazon.com. We're in the BlackBerry podcast directory. We're on the Stitcher app. We're on the Windows Phone thingy, too. So we're everywhere. We are ubiquitous. You can check out our Brewer's Logbook at BasicBrewingShop.com. In the front is a blank calendar that you can use to track your fermentations and plan your brews. And there is room in the back to log the details of up to 50 batches of beer. If you want to put a tip in our tip jar, some coinage in our guitar case, our virtual guitar case, you can go to basicbrewing.com/support, and thanks to everybody who has done so already. Protect your precious beer with one of our growler bags. Check those out at basicbrewingshop.com, especially important here in the Northern Hemisphere now that the weather is warming up. The Basic Brewing bottle openers are back in stock and headed out the door again. For a limited time, you can get a free opener with the purchase of any of our DVD combos. I want to say before I get on to the content that we're thinking about everybody in the past few days who's been hit by all these nasty tornadoes, just incredible. They predicted, you know, a nasty situation with a risk of really heavy, long track, strong tornadoes, and boy, it worked. I mean, the forecast came true, and I hope that. You know, a lot of people were saved because of the accuracy of that forecast. But, you know, we lost 16 people in the state of Arkansas. And the last total I saw was more than 30 people died, you know, in the South in the past few days. So just horrible, horrible stuff. And I hope that that everybody that you know and you care about is okay. And just wanted to say that we're thinking about everybody in that situation. And I appreciate, the reason I bring it up is because every time something happens in Arkansas, we get a lot of kind notes and tweets and Facebook messages and things like that asking if we're okay. And luckily for us here in Northwest Arkansas, the damage was down in the central part of the state and we were untouched. So we are happy about that, and thank you very much for all your concern. But we're in the Basic Brewing family. We're all okay up here. So just thinking about everybody who isn't. Just scary stuff. In happier things, looking in the mailbag, there is this from the American Homebrewers Association. They say, in honor of National Homebrew Day, which falls every year on May 7th, each year, the American Homebrewers Association celebrates AHA Big Brew on the first Saturday in May. That's coming up this Saturday. This year, throughout the day on May 3rd, hundreds of bars, breweries, shops, and clubs all over the country will host their local communities to brew on site for a national same-day homebrewing session. At noon Central Daylight Time, all homebrewers and beer lovers are encouraged to raise a glass of homebrew in a simultaneous toast that celebrates those who craft outstanding homemade beer, mead, and wine for their friends and loved ones. A number of suggested homebrew recipes are selected for AHA Big Brew participants to follow. This year's recipes, which consist of a pale ale, stout, and dark lager, are all gold medal winners from last year's National Homebrew Competition, the world's largest beer competition. So you can go to homebrewersassociation.org for more information on that. It's May already, and that means the National Homebrewers Conference is coming up in a month, in June, in Grand Rapids. And I've been working on my presentation, which will be on Saturday afternoon. I hope that you will come and check it out. I'll be talking about small batch brewing. And I'm really grateful to the AHA for not putting me first thing on Saturday morning. I've done that slot before, and it's not a lot of fun to be up early on the day after club night. So come and see me on Saturday afternoon. And as an early warning, remember that we take the month of June off from posting podcast episodes, so by my calculations, there are only 4 more Basic Brewing Radio episodes before the break, and I am also planning on posting a couple of video episodes in May as well. Well, let's get on to our conversation with the two Dr. Chrises. You may remember an article that Chris Colby wrote on beerandwinejournal.com about a presentation that Chris White did on the effect that different yeast strains have on the bitterness of finished beers. I wanted to get the two Chrises together to talk about that. And while we had Chris White on the line, we got him to talk about safety tips on brewing lambics, safety concerns about long-term storage of no-chill wort, and whether eating dry yeast before a night of drinking has any effect on your sobriety. Dr. Chris White, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And Dr. Chris Colby, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thanks, James.
We are together because Chris Colby wrote an article on Beer and Wine Journal a while back on a presentation that you, Chris White, did at the Dixie Cup on a study that you guys are doing on different yeast strains and how they affect the bitterness of beers. Can you kind of give us the long and short of that?
Well, we make a lot of different yeast strains. We package about 80 plus strains, different strains a week. And then we've been doing that for a long time. And then a couple of years ago, we put a little brewery into White Labs here in San Diego with a tasting room. So we have about 30 beers on tap that we make and sell here. And each one has a different yeast strain, and they're different beer styles in their IPA and porter and pale ale and things like that. So we've done about 2,000 beers now, and some of those very small and some of the larger batches. And we just started looking at the statistics with the different yeast strains and the different styles and some of the parameters, like the, you know, just kind of to build a better descriptions for each of our yeast strains. That's one of the goals of the brewery. It's kind of an R&D thing for us. We just happen to sell the beer. We found some cool stuff that we're still putting together. But one thing that we found was that some strains, there was higher IBU levels consistently across different beer styles with some strains and less IBUs in the same batches with other strains. So it looks to be like a strain-specific phenomenon of, plus or minus the IBUs you would calculate.
Yeah, anecdotally, I can kind of chime in there in that there was one time I brewed the same hoppy ale recipe back-to-back, one with, the California ale yeast and another with an English strain, and there was a marked difference in the hop character of the beers. So
yeah, that's a really good one because that English yeast, being a real common yeast, that is one that we've noticed that in the past too, that it's always a little bit lower than Cal, and noticeably lower. But then a lot of the other strains we didn't have as much experience with in that way.
So what are the trends that you're seeing? I mean, which are the ones that are better for hoppy beers and which are the ones that are kind of more muted?
Well, we'll try to eventually publish this whole thing so you can see all of it. But right now I've been kind of presenting it a few times and talking about it. And sure enough, you see with California with higher IBU levels, and you see a lot of the more wild type strains, the Hefeweizen strains and Trappist strains and things like that, being below the level you would expect, even less than, say, English ale yeast, things like that. And then those beers are a little less obvious because people aren't usually making hoppy beers, very bitter beers, you know, with those different kind of yeast strains, with the more wild type strains, the specialty strains.
And this isn't just a matter of perception. It's measured IBUs.
Exactly, right. This is not just sensory. This is we're doing the full ASBC method to extract the isoalpha acids and then quantitate them on a spectrophotometer. And so you actually know how much isoalpha acids is in that particular beer. And then we looked at how much we calculate, you know, because we're calculating the using Beersmith and doing it with the recipes that way, and it gives you a calculated IBU level. And so we put that in each time, and then the kind of the expected, and then the result.
So where are the IBUs going? Where are the alpha acids going?
It's a good question. You know, there's different theories on where it's going. Nobody really knows. People have... are the yeast metabolizing them? You know, people have been looking at this for a long time. There's papers that I've found back to the 60s that people have kind of looked at it. And it's in trub, you know, maybe a whole flocculation. You know, one theory has been like with English ale yeast. Well, a more flocculent strain is creating these bigger clumps and maybe entrapping some of the alpha acids, and they're just coming out of solution, you know, via the flocculation. But then when we find some other strains that really don't flocculate well at all, that are also having low IBU, lower than expected IBU levels, it's probably not that.
Yeah, the Hefeweizen's not very flocculent. So
right.
It's interesting. I mean, I guess in theory, if the IBUs were coming out with flocculation, you could test the residue at the bottom of the fermenters and see if there was a difference there.
Yeah, and that's probably a good thing to do, to kind of look at that and see, you know, if we could find them there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess this is more relevant nowadays because people are playing more, it seems, by crossing characteristics of different beer styles. For instance, hoppy Belgian beers are, you know, over the past few years have become more popular. So people are kind of bending the rules of the style guidelines, and so, you know, is this kind of one of the things that that made you think about this?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I didn't really expect it until we just started looking again at the data and running a lot of these statistics, and so we really almost didn't predict it. We didn't set out to do that kind of study. I mean, we were looking at attenuation and other things the same way that we know varies in a consistent way. But now that looking at this, I'm thinking that you could, if we had basically a correction factor with different yeasts, that might be part of be something you could use in your formula when you're designing a recipe. If you want a certain IBUs and you know what strain you're using, maybe the recipe calculator is going to incorporate a factor, you know, to multiply or divide that by to get the right, to get a more expected IBU level. And I think that's one thing we're studying now. We're trying to predict that using different strains and the batches we're making going forward right now and seeing if we can use a formula.
So it's yet another variable to put in these IBU calculation formulas that fond of.
Exactly. You know, because what we found is, so, you know, if we say one you know, if you expect a certain IBU level and that's what you got, like, you know, 001 is about that. California ale yeast comes out about that level. If you add a certain amount of, you use California ale yeast in different beer styles, you add your hops, you look at your IBU, you measure your IBUs, it comes out almost exactly as expected at that one level. And there's strains that are, you get more IBUs than you expected. So wow. California is also still doing something with the hop material. It's just not as much as the other strains. so it still stays at one. WLP810, our San Francisco lager yeast, is something like 1.1 something, you know, so it's higher than one. 005 is over one, the British ale yeast, which is just as flocculent as the English ale yeast.
So there are strains that are actually magnifying the, exactly. The hoppiness.
There's less of those. The majority are right around one or lower, but there are some that are higher, yeah.
How does, maybe this isn't known, how does pitching rate affect that? Could you, if you wanted to make a very hoppy beer, could you say under pitch with the idea that, well, I'm going to have fewer yeast in there? Or, I mean, but then that, of course, the yeast are going to multiply. So does your pitching rate going to affect that, or...
I think it's a very good question, because if the yeast are actually doing something with the IBUs, with the isohop acids, then yeah, I would expect that more yeast growth would have more impact. So perhaps it would magnify that difference with different pitching rates. We have not looked at different pitching rates yet, but I think it's a great question.
That's how it always goes in science. You do one good experiment and someone else wants you to do a bunch of others.
Right.
What you should have done was...
And you're living with, or you're working with living organisms, so that's, it's not a piece of machinery that you can, you know, dial in. So that adds to the fun as well.
Yeah.
Well, that, so when do you think that you'll have, the research, finished? Or are you going to publish it all at once, or are you going to kind of dribble and drabble out the
numbers? No, we already started working on the publication. We hope to get it published or submitted this fall.
Cool.
Finish some other experiments, so I think you'll see it this year.
Great.
Yeah, that'll be fun.
Yeah.
While I've got you on the line, I wanted to pick your brain about some other things as well. And we're talking, well, first of all, like for instance, I went over to Prairie Artisan Ales over in Tulsa, a couple weeks ago, and Chase Healy had, in a barrel over there, a lambic that, he had inoculated by, putting the wort into a dairy tank, in the back of his pickup truck one cold winter evening. And so, and I've talked to other home brewers who have started playing with sort of harvesting their own microflora. And I kind of want to get, first of all, your reaction to this sort of trend of, bringing the lambic tradition over into home brewing and commercial breweries over here. As a yeast manufacturer, are you intimidated by that?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I think it's fun, and we do a lot of work for commercial breweries on that, where we'll collect unique yeast strains and so bank certain strains. And so in home brewing, perhaps there's not as much market for us, because we probably can't go to every home brewer's house and get some certain strains and things. but I think it's fun for people to play with, and there are a lot of yeast, different strains out there all over in honey and different parts of different environments, but very few of them can make a good beer. So that's when it comes to the experimentation part and doing little fermentations. And finding, if you have a good beer or not, because there are a lot of yeast that you will find in doing collections that are not safe. Mm. So you got to be a little careful. And the parameter that we look for, if we're doing any kind of selection of wild strains, is do they ferment? Do they create alcohol? Do they ferment the sugars? And then if they do, then they're going to be. We consider those that they're going to be safe, because we don't know any strains that produce alcohol that aren't.
Really? So there are even yeast strains that aren't safe?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
So not only – well, okay, let's – I was going to ask you just about guidelines about how to brew a lambic successfully, but what are the safety guidelines that – I mean, is
one thing is to look at that gravity and see that the gravity is dropping. See that you're getting fermentation. That means you're most likely getting some Saccharomyces in there, and you're creating some alcohol. And if you have what looks to be a normal fermentation, then I would go ahead and sample it and things. But if it never really ferments, if it goes sort of putrid, I would not keep it. I would not blend it into anything else. I would dispose of it.
Hmm. Let me give you an example. And people who listen to the show regularly are getting sick of me talking about my fig. But this past fall, I picked a fig off my fig tree, and I put it into a bit of starter wort and left it there overnight, and then took the fig out the next day and then put the starter wort on a stir plate. And, you know, I saw activity in there, and it's been obviously in the flask for several months now. And I haven't gotten the courage up to taste it yet. I keep talking to experts to try to, you know, talk up my my courage. So what do I look at to make sure that that is okay for me to ingest and then to put into another batch of beer?
Well, you could take you could make a batch of beer and say take, you know, 100 mils or a liter or so, but it could be a small amount. Put it in a separate sanitized container, add some of the material that you have from the fig, and see what happens in a little test fermentation.
And just if I get alcohol, it's okay?
Yeah, I think so.
Well, that sounds simple enough. I mean, it smells pretty good. At first, the smell has evolved over time. It started out with kind of a nail polish kind of a thing, and now it smells more kind of like a tart, you know, kind of more familiar to something that I've actually had from a bottle with a label on it. So I'm less afraid of it nowadays.
Because we know that pathogenic organisms, we don't know of any that survive in beer fermentation. And that's why beer is so safe. Because a lot of those organisms need oxygen or are killed by the ethanol, the low pH. So those combination of things, remove that harm. So if you do this little fermentation and you get alcohol, I'd be confident that you could then taste it.
Which leads us to another article that Chris wrote on beerandwinejournal.com. And maybe you want to talk about that one, Chris Colby. Your article on long-term storage of wort in no-chill containers.
Yeah. Well, just to set it up, with no-chill brewing these days, there's a technique that people do is they'll boil their wort. Then they'll run it off to a sanitized container, and a popular choice for that is these plastic food grade plastic cubes that are, I think they're temperature rated to like 180 degrees Fahrenheit, something like that.
Okay.
And so they'll run the wort that's been boiled off into these cubes. Push the cubes are sort of semi collapsible, or actually they're collapsible, and. They'll push the air out of it, seal it up, and then just let the wort cool on its own. And then additionally, some people save that wort for an extended period of time. And the story I wrote was that these people are running the risk of growing botulism in their wort, because in order to kill botulism, you need to boil at, well, to really get rid of it, you need to heat the solution up to about 250 degrees Fahrenheit, or your food safety guidelines allow 240 for 20 minutes, with the idea that you're later going to heat the food and any stray botulism toxin is going to be destroyed. And so you need to be, you know, like when you, if you were going to can wort, and go by the standard, canning, you know, rules that the USDA has set out for, you know, canning vegetables and anything low acid, is the basic rule is if it's under a pH of 4.6, you can boil it and just can it using the boiling water method. But if the pH is over 4.6, you need to use a pressure canner, which allows you to reach 240 or 250 if you dial it up to 10 or 15 PSI. Right. And so, anyway, I just wrote this article saying that if you're simply boiling your wort under normal conditions, running it off to a sanitized container, you're running the risk of botulism. And it's not a large risk, even in the United States with whatever our population is. There's only, you know, a few hundred cases of botulism every year. But still, the consequences for getting botulism can be quite severe. You know, it's a neurotoxin, and you just basically, it starts paralyzing you, and eventually, in the worst cases, you either have to be put on a ventilator or put in a casket.
Yeah, and I guess the big concern that you outlined was that if they took this wort, if there had been the botulism organism in there being active, there would be created this botulinum toxin, which would not be denatured by the alcohol. I mean, if you then fermented the wort, it would kill the botulism organism, supposedly.
Right.
But the toxin would still be there, and it would have to be denatured by heating. And since they are not reheating this wort that they've been storing in these no-chill containers, they're basically just taking the wort, taking it from the no-chill container and putting it into a fermenter and pitching yeast, that if there was the botulinum toxin in the wort, that it would still be in the beer after fermentation.
Right. And the toxin for botulism is actually, the botulinum toxin, it's either the most deadly toxin or one of the most deadly. The LD50 on it is like, it's in the neighborhood of 1 to 2 nanograms per kilogram. So it's like, as little as 100 nanograms, that could be lethal to a normal size adult. So it only needs a teeny bit. And, in normal beer brewing, it's not a problem, because even if there is somehow the botulism spores in the wort, you pitch the yeast ferment it, and it's, you know, within a matter of days or maybe even less, you know, the pH has dropped below 4.6, and it takes time for the botulism organism to grow. And I think actually the toxin is produced when it sporulates again. So in normal brewing, you know, everything happens so fast that it doesn't have a chance to grow. But if you were to store your wort, and, you know, there are people who have stored it, you know, for months, and you know, it wasn't heated to the point where the botulism toxin is going to be, or I'm sorry, the botulism bacteria is going to be killed, the spores. There's just running a risk there.
Yeah. So, Chris White, what's your reaction? Do you think that this is a safety concern?
Well, I'm not an expert in that field, but I think Chris did his homework, and it sounds right to me that there's a risk there, because that's why those guidelines were created. That's why you have pressure cookers at home that would be similar to an autoclave that hospitals would use, and biotech companies and white labs. So we do heat our wort to 250 degrees. To kill all spores and all things, not so much that we're going to store it, but that we are going to be growing these microorganisms from very small amounts, and we want it completely clean. So when you do the boil in a brewery or at home or whatever, you are not killing all living things. It's a boil. So spores will not be killed. A lot of spores, you know, right? So that's why you pitch the yeast right after you boil, because contaminants can grow. And there's no reason why botulism wouldn't be a risk. I mean, it's always, as you say, a small risk, but I think it is a risk by storing the wort and not boiling it again.
Now, we got some pushback from Pat Hollingdale, who's been recently on the show. Pat's the one of the fathers of Brew in a Bag Brewing down in Australia. And he is not a main proponent of no chill, but he does use it. So Pat's question is, does wort, which has a certain specific gravity, constitute a high or low sugar environment when it comes to botulism? So are there, is beer wort, or can you have a beer wort that is so high gravity that it is not in danger of being inoculated by botulism?
Not once you, you know, not once you do your mash and you have your liquid solution. I mean, you have to be in the syrups categories, you know, over 80% solids to be wort. The you know, honeys and syrups, those aren't going to grow bacteria usually, but even those can sometimes on the surface of stuff get some contaminants and some molds and things. But those are the concentrations where usually they're safe from microorganisms. But a beer wort is certainly not anywhere near that kind of concentration. So no, that's an ideal breeding ground for bacteria. And the bacteria is what's going to produce the toxin, so the Clostridium bacteria. So I don't think the sugar is going to be a problem at all. Or help in any way.
So in my, I have a question. Is these plastic containers, when you put hot wort in there and you squeeze out the air and you seal it and then the wort cools, it collapses even further.
Right.
Would a botulism contamination or infection, would it necessarily create a circumstance where the container bulged back out? I mean, is that the telltale sign that you've got a botulism contamination, is bulging containers?
I don't know if Chris might have a different answer, but it just depends how much gas it produces, you know. So if it doesn't produce much gas, no. And the bacteria itself is anaerobic, so by getting the air out, that's not really going to help prevent the growth of this particular bacteria. It's just fine in anaerobic conditions. So you only see that if the yeast makes CO2, or the bacteria in this case, you know, makes CO2. That would cause the expansion. And it wouldn't necessarily have to create a lot of CO2.
So that's kind of scary. I've always heard that if you see a bulging can in the supermarket, don't buy it because there's something wrong with that.
Oh,
can.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So that is definitely a telltale sign.
Right. That's a definite telltale sign. I'm just saying, just because it doesn't, I don't think says there's no problem.
Right.
Right. Right. If you would open the cube up, if it would smell putrid, that would be a sign, because some of the forms of botulism or the bacteria, some of them are putrefying. And of course, there are other just regular spoilage microorganisms that are too. If there is gas being produced in the stored wort, something's living in it. You don't know what it is, but I wouldn't run the risk. But conversely, it could look fine. You know, the botulinum toxin is so, you know, works at such a tiny, in such tiny doses that you don't need a ton of growth from the botulism bacteria to produce it. You know, like I said, 100 nanograms, what is that, 1/10 of a milligram, just nothing, you know. roughly, it's just, and I mean, the thing I think is it's just not worth it. If you just pitch the wort with brewer's yeast the next day, you know, not only have you eliminated the risk of botulism, but you've made beer, you know, rather than having a cube of wort sitting around.
Right.
Well, I think,
I agree. Yeah. And I think by adding it in hot, as you suggest, and then getting the air out, you know, that's going to, as that cools down, as it's still cooling, if you put it in hot enough, you'll still get some pasteurization units out of that, and you can probably calculate how many you do get and then look at some tables. But if you don't do that, if you go in if you cool the wort and then go in, then that's a disaster.
that would be doubly bad.
Yeah.
So could they be pasteurizing their wort by putting it in to this container hot and letting it just sit?
That basically is. Yeah, I mean, you are getting some pasteurization units out of that if you're over 180 degrees when you're doing it.
But there are certain guidelines that you got to follow. I mean, there are certain time periods that you've got to hold.
Right. Pasteurization is not a yes or a no. It's a process or a time, and there's so many pasteurization units you can calculate and see what your risk is. But it's still not that 250 degrees. That's going to kill the spores and everything. Pasteurization is never that temperature.
So even pasteurization is not a guarantee.
Right.
So that's we nervous Nellies are saying that that if you're going to do no chill, you should probably pitch your wort maybe the next day just to be perfectly safe.
The USDA in its canning recommendations. And also the FDA also has a separate set of like food packaging that matches very closely for commercial people, but they give 3 to 4 days as the minimum amount of time that sufficient botulism bacteria can grow to produce, you know, enough toxin to cause a problem. So yeah, I would say pitch the yeast the next couple days to be safe.
And Chris Colby, you were telling me that one concern that you didn't put in the article was that, I mean, even if the risk is minuscule, if somebody does get hurt or poison themselves or a beer judge somewhere across the country with dangerous homebrew, that is a potential setback for the legalization of our hobby.
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine? Think of all the no-brain politicians we have in the world, and suddenly somebody gets it under their, you know, a bee in their bonnet that homebrewing is, you know, killing people. That would just be, yeah, it could potentially spell big problems. Yeah, like, one of the major reasons that distilling is not legal in a home environment is because of the risks of, you know, you need to know what you're doing, or you end up drinking methanol. So it's a health risk thing, but at least the one nice thing homebrewing has for it is we can say, you know, pathogens don't live in beer. You know, you're not going to make yourself sick from homebrew, well, at least from pathogens. You can certainly drink enough to the alcohol.
I have some anecdotal evidence to the contrary.
Yeah. I went to a beer festival once and but it can't make you sick via a pathogen, you know, so it's safe that way. And, I just think we would be better to err on the side of keeping it that way, because there's always people who are going to want to, try to ban or restrict homebrewing. The pendulum's sort of swinging in our favor right now, but nothing lasts forever.
So I have one last thing, more of on a lighter note. Let's end on a lighter note.
Lighter than botulism?
I know it's hard to imagine, but there was an article on Esquire recently. I don't know if you guys have read this, but it was an article on how Jim Cook from Sam Adams explains how he can drink beer all night and not get drunk. Have you guys both seen this article?
I have.
Yeah, I saw that.
Well, the secret to drinking all night and not getting drunk is that apparently for years, Jim Cook has swallowed your standard Fleischmann's dry yeast before he drinks, stirring the, quote, white powdery substance in with some yogurt to make it more palatable. One teaspoon per beer right before you start drinking. And apparently, active dry yeast has an enzyme in it called alcohol dehydrogenases, I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Roughly put, ADH is able to break down alcohol molecules down into their constituent parts of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. So what do you guys think about this? Can you eat dry yeast before you start drinking and remain sober all night? Chris White, you want to take a stab at this?
Well, it's an interesting idea, but I mean, yes, yeast have alcohol dehydrogenase, but so do we. That's how we first metabolize the ethanol. So all you would be doing is boosting that up a little bit. I guess the idea is getting it before it gets in the bloodstream. I don't know, but that would also be inside the yeast cell. So we're going to have to lyse those cells pretty quickly when we consume them to allow that alcohol dehydrogenase to work on the ethanol. So it sounds a little far-fetched to me.
And if a few teaspoons of yeast could detoxify ethanol, which, you know, alcohol dehydrogenase catalyzes the reaction of ethanol to acetaldehyde, if it did that at a rate high enough that it was going to prevent you from getting drunk during the course of an evening, how is it that beer has any alcohol in it ever? You know, you would leave it on the yeast cake overnight and, you know, you would have barley-flavored water. Yeah, it's – there's problems with are the yeast going to operate in the pH of the stomach, you know, at that level? And even if you lyse the cells, how much ADH is there? And, you know, also in brewer's yeast, obviously they – although they have the enzyme to convert it to acetaldehyde, it's not upregulated to the point where they do that at a very high rate, because, you know, the organism itself uses that ethanol to kill off, you know, basically everything else.
So I guess the big question is, was Jim Cook pranking this guy?
Well, the article came out in April, so he could have interviewed him on April 1st. I've never met Jim Cook, but I suspect he knows how beer brewing works.
And Chris White, would you be a proponent of heaping teaspoons of dry yeast by itself?
Well, you know, active yeast also has a tenacity for taking up a lot of minerals, and that's why we don't usually do that, because it can strip some minerals from you that you need. Because that's what yeast do. They're really good at that. So that's why they're used to clean up some spills and things like that. So, no, I don't think it's I'm not going to do it.
Plus, I think it seems like you'd get gas pretty bad from just eating a bunch of yeast.
That's another thing. Yeah. I mean, I'm always up for an experiment. I might try it once.
And there's a new product line for you.
Yeah. I think I'll out of that product.
Well, I've certainly enjoyed your products over the years. It's really good stuff. I have this bag of empty White Labs capsules or whatever tubes in my basement. And I counted them up. I've got 44 that I need to. Do you still do the turn-in program where you can get a discount on yeast if you turn in your old containers?
Yes, we sure do. We call it Customer Club. So you sign up for that, and then you can you get a newsletter and stuff, and then you can return yeast for defined levels. The first level is just at 10 vials. So
wow,
yeah, we get old yeast vials coming back here every day.
And how many do you have to save up to get you to come to our house to brew?
5,000. And, you know, that was just sort of done by one of a marketing person that used to work at White Labs, Joanne Carilli. And it was just a joke. But you know what happened? People started collecting them. I've already done a couple of visits. Yes.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah, I was going to say, that wouldn't be out of reach for like a homebrew club, a moderate-sized homebrew club.
Clubs got together, so I did one in Norfolk, Virginia, and one in Detroit. And
nice.
There's other clubs and groups saying that they're very close. So we made a great, you know, fun weekend out of it each time. So.
Well, yeah, shoot, if they spend enough to get 5,000 vials, you know, I think that's a good investment. The plane trip or the plane ticket.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. That's a lot of fermentation.
That's a lot of fermentation.
Well, awesome. Well, this has been a lot of fun, and I appreciate you guys getting together. And will we be seeing you in Grand Rapids?
I will definitely be there.
Awesome. Well, thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, James.
Well, thanks again to Chris and to Chris. In addition to founding White Labs Yeast, Chris White is co-author of Yeast, The Practical Guide to Beer Fermentation, along with Jamil Zainashev, which is in my collection of books. I'm looking forward to the information on the effects of the different strains on beer bitterness, and I'm guessing that there may be some surprises, and that will be another tool to help us brew the beer that we want and that we're expecting when we're formulating our recipes. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com, or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. You will find our new bottle openers on our shop. Our Basic Brewing growler bags are also available. Protect your precious homebrew and craft beers. You take it from place to place. Check out our support link where you can throw us a couple of bucks into our tip jar by subscribing financially to our podcasts. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site, along with combo deals to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time, and a free bottle opener is included with all of our DVD combos for a limited time. You can check out our shirts in the store, too. Our Brewer's Logbooks are on the store. Keep track of up to 50 batches of beer. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com, and if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We greatly appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Draft Beer Jelly Belly, 1 pound. And I joked on Twitter that Jelly Belly's had a beer-flavored jelly bean for quite a while. Bad lager. Badly fermented lager, otherwise known as buttered popcorn. And Bell Minnie Mouse Sprinter Toddler Bike Helmet. Thanks again, everybody. Remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. Greatly appreciate your support. Don't forget, you can also join the American Homebrewers Association and subscribe to Brew Your Own Magazine through the associate links on basicbrewing.com. That's all. Until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dunst. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.